This was a crucial question for the debates in one presidential election year. Belt buckle or no belt buckle? Make no mistake, everything that appeared on TV in the 1976 debates between the President of the United States, Gerald Ford, and his Democratic challenger, Jimmy Carter, was prearranged. It was the first time anyone had debated an incumbent live on TV, and it wasn't something the Carter's team wanted. As the challenger, he had a double-digit lead, and he didn't need this live television event. His team was wary of their guy being next to a POTUS live on TV. Ford challenged Carter to a debate in a surprise declaration in his acceptance speech at the RNC convention in Kansas City that year. "The people deserve to hear from us," he boldly declared. We take debates for granted now, right? After the conventions, we go to the debates. It's part of the election. But if President Ford had not been so far down in the polls compared to this out-of-nowhere refreshing new candidate with a peanut farmer smile, so not Watergate, so un-Nixon, so dis-imperial presidency, who was running around the country taking shots at President Ford, who didn't have the strain of governing, if he didn't need to get this guy in the ring, it's doubtful whether we would even have TV debates as part of our politics now. Yes, they had those debates in 1960, but don't forget, Lyndon Johnson didn't debate Goldwater in 64, Nixon didn't debate Humphrey in 68, nor McGovern in 72. Debates could have been a fluke of early television and forgotten about. But then came 1976, and of course Carter, once challenged, couldn't say no. But he would do everything he could to make himself equal to a president of the United States. Height was a factor. Ford was 3.5 inches taller than Carter. Not that much taller, but enough to worry about. How would it look? So the arrangement was made. Carter's podium would go to 1 inch below his belt buckle. Ford's podium would go 2 inches above his belt buckle, knocking down that imperial presidency a little bit. In exchange, Ford's people would get something that they wanted. They get to pick the background color, the blue that they felt would be good against his thinning hair, and a brace to hold Ford's glass of water on the podium. He had been the butt of jokes as a klutz, and if he dropped that water during the debate, Chevy Chase would never have let him forget it. But if Ford thought he was going to nonchalantly put a seal of the President of the United States on his podium, he had another thing coming from Carter's negotiation team. Now, Ford's people just said, "Hey, that seal goes wherever the president goes. Here he's speaking. Every time he's speaking, that seal's there." "No way," Carter's team said. "President's never debated before. He's not having that seal here." That little bit of negotiation has lasted through time and debates. Of course, 4 years later, it didn't stop Carter's people from trying to put a seal on his podium during his debate with Reagan, which was also rejected. Next, would the candidates stand or sit? Would they stand when one is talking and then sit down after they're done? Well, that one required the debate negotiators to actually call Ford and Carter to get their permission. They would stand, statesmanlike. It was a long way from the days of, "My dear sir, will it be agreeable to make an arrangement for you and myself to divide time and address the same audiences in the present canvass, your obedient servant, A. Lincoln?" That letter to Senator Stephen Douglas that began the process of a series of well-publicized debates that would help make Lincoln a presidential contender. The answer back was yes, of course, and let's do it in each of Illinois' congressional districts. Lincoln accepted, and Douglas picked Ottawa, Freeport, Jonesboro, Charleston, Galesburg, Quincy, and Alton. And he said, I will speak at Ottawa first, you at Freeport, and then we will alternate. Abraham Lincoln responds, although by terms you propose, you take four openings to my three, I accede and thus close the arrangement. A little 19th century snark from A. Lincoln, but nonetheless the negotiations for America's most famous debate were finished right there with letters between the candidates. The memory of that debate 100 years before was on the minds of 1950s America. Few trial runs, too, with this new medium of television. Primary appearances with Adlai Stevenson and Estes Kefauver battling for the presidential nomination in 1956. And as the number of TV sets in homes had increased from 4.4 million in 1950 to 40 million in 1960, some 88%, TV was important. The candidates had to speak to it. Something else was going on. This new TV medium was seen as less intelligent than the written word, was being criticized. It was competing with the key opinion makers and considered thoughts, the newspaper and the magazine. It might be out of control. And then the idea that game show contestants had been coached to lose so that someone else could win the prize triggered congressional hearings, which what we were seeing on TV, really what we were seeing, scandal, scandal. So in 1960, the network said that they'd give at least 8 hours each to the two candidates. But the networks would still wish to control how it was used, how it was presented, to make it the most interesting to viewers. They did not want to have Adlai Stevenson's talking head on for an hour. They inquired of the campaigns as to a Lincoln-Douglas-like series of great debates on TV for 1960, with both candidates of both parties appearing together. Kennedy's campaign was quick to accept. President Eisenhower suggested that his vice president running that year, Richard Nixon, not accept. He should not stoop to a challenger's level and give Kennedy an opportunity that he otherwise wouldn't have. He was, after all, the vice president of the United States. But after being questioned about it in a press conference and a lot of pressure in the news media and on TV, Nixon accepted. Nixon was known to be a good debater. He had handled TV before. He had shown up Nikita Khrushchev, a little impromptu TV debate that they had. I knew that it would be a Kennedy advantage, Nixon said in his memoirs, noting that Kennedy could take the offense and Nixon would be forced on the defense defending the Eisenhower record. But, he said, there was no way I could refuse to debate without the media and the Kennedy campaign turning the refusal into a campaign issue. The question was, Nixon said, how to give Kennedy less advantage. Thus, they began negotiations at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York. There would be four debates. The second and the fourth would be press conference style. Press would ask questions, the candidates answered, and the first and the third would be more of a debate style. Topics presented, statements, and rebuttals. Nixon's negotiations would prove to be critical to the outcome of the debates, figuring that the audience for the last debate would be the highest. Now, there was no precedent for these TV debates before. Nixon insisted on discussing the foreign policy information last. And he later admitted it turned out to be his biggest mistake, because the first debate was watched by more people, and that debate was on domestic issues. Now, Kennedy, as a member of the House and Senate Labor Committee, was able to handle domestic policy quite easily. When you look at most of the TV debates that we have had since 1960, a lot of it is based on the precedent set in that CBS studios in that year. Most of it from the Nixon people. They insisted on having lecterns, first simply having candidates standing. They insisted on a table between the media and the two candidates. They wanted a good distance between Nixon and Kennedy. Nixon wanted both candidates sitting down. Here, Kennedy's people objected. Kennedy's people knew that Nixon had hurt his knee, and the standing would cause him to jerk a bit, which would look unstable, throw him off a bit. And you thought football was the only sport where injuries were taken advantage of. Okay, Nixon said, but they asked that the candidates sit down while the other candidate was speaking, limiting reaction shots or any upstaging while Nixon was speaking. Yes, these debate negotiations have not always been based on principled matters. In 1984, Democrats would negotiate an hour and a half debate with President Ronald Reagan. Why? So that they could discuss the issues in a more robust fashion, right? Knowing his age and knowing that his responses would tend to be more of the scripted variety, it had always been his style, the good sound bites, his prepared answers. Knowing that they would run out after a certain point of time, they insisted on a longer format. And indeed, in their first debate, Democratic candidate Walter Mondale performed surprisingly well, and Reagan meandered, one of his worst performances on television ever. Yet in the second debate, he would make quick work of his Democratic opponent. Mondale would get no third chance at the debates. His team had given up three debates for that length of an hour and a half that they wanted. Usually a president, at least a front-running president, wants less debates. A challenger usually wants more. It means more TV time, more time to get the message out, to be seen by new voters. 1976 reversed that trend a bit as Ford was president and happened to be the underdog. In 1980, Carter came close to refusing to debate at all. Reagan's campaign would debate, but only if third-party candidate Anderson was in the debate as the sponsor, the League of Women Voters, insisted. In the end, to get rid of Anderson, Reagan's team, led by James Baker, insisted on a single debate 1 week before the elections. Carter was under heavy criticism for having refused to debate previously. It was a way to get rid of Anderson and a way to move on with a debate in the election. He took it. Carter's poor performance in this one debate would give him no time to recover. Indeed, there was no doubt that James Baker is one of the better debate negotiators. In 1980, he got that one debate before, and that was probably his biggest victory, that one debate before the 1980 election. This did two things, Baker's estimation. It limited the amount of time that Carter could respond to anything that occurred in the debate, but it also would, in effect, freeze Reagan's lead. This is a little-noticed trend. A debate announcement freezes an election, in a sense, because everyone is focused for weeks on the upcoming debate. So it's hard for an underdog candidate to change the election or create news. Reporters just keep going back to the theme of, well, wait for those debates. This happened to Carter. But the date also boxed him in. Had he been done better in the debate than he did, he would have only a week to benefit from that gain. And since he didn't perform well, he had no time to recover. The election result, in terms of the number of states Carter won, was worse than most political experts had predicted before that debate was held. Baker also got the two debates in 1984 and told Dukakis' negotiator in 1988 that they would get two debates, take it or leave it. There's few concessions to the Dukakis camp. They did agree to a VP debate, now precedent anyway, and a riser on Dukakis' platform that would help to adjust for the candidate's height vis-a-vis President Bush. Not without an insult during the negotiations, apparently, from Baker. What is your guy going to do, he said, according to one person in negotiations, when he has to go up against Gorbachev? Something else occurred in these debates. In 1984 and 1988, a new device was created, a memo of understanding between the two parties. This agreement hasn't always rubbed everyone the right way. In 1984, after 60 potential media panelists were rejected between the two campaigns as they kind of one-upped each other, and the League of Women Voters issued a press release attacking both sides in the negotiation, and top newspapers pulled their reporters from being involved in any TV debates. The League of Women Voters conduct election debates all over the country for state and local positions, some congressional races, some primary. And in 1976, they had run the debates. When the League saw the 1988 agreement between the two parties, the restrictions on who could participate, just the two major parties, and what questions could be asked, and who would be the moderators, they called it a fraud on the American people. Undeterred, Paul Kirk and Frank Farenkov, representatives of their respective Democrat and Republican parties, formed the Commission on Presidential Debates in 1987. And since then, they have handled presidential debates. The League of Women Voters was not happy at the time and issued a scathing press release that said They are trying to steal the debates. Unlike the commission, no one at the league has a stake in the election. But what the parties did have were the two guys. And indeed, when the league sent invites that year to their debate, the campaigns declined. Despite the creation of the CPD, ostensibly for better negotiations and smoother debates, it was still not completely guaranteed that there would be debate between presidential candidates. Indeed, in 1992, the Bush campaign held off, not sure about how they'd do against challenger Clinton. Then a campaign of Clinton staffers, initially done at the local level, but it spread throughout the country, of staffers wearing chicken suits wherever the president would be, made debate avoidance impossible, especially after a Midwestern train tour where President Bush debated with a man in a chicken suit and asked him if he was from the Arkansas River. Once he was forced into it and accepted debates, he asked for the most. He asked for 4 debates to be held in the last 4 weeks of the election running up to Election Day, something that a front runner really wouldn't like. Some Clinton aides felt that they'd really done it. As they met Bush's debate negotiators in Mickey Cantor's office, their big fear was, were they going to have to go up against Jim Baker? They knew how he had ripped previous teams to shreds. The guy negotiated in the Middle East, for God's sakes, an aide told a newspaper anonymously. But they were relieved when Bob Teeter and a few other aides walked through the door instead of Baker. And the Clinton people got most of what they wanted, a town hall-type debate. We were hooting and hollering in the office when we got that, Paul Begala said. Clinton, they felt, was the rock star of retail politics, and he'd be able to touch the audience, feel their pain, which in the second debate, that was a town hall style, he certainly did. Yet Bush's people in 92 hadn't quite seen it as a threat either. Just a moderate speaker in large audiences, President Bush had always been good with little groups, and the Richmond, Virginia audience, they felt, may be sympathetic to him. So they agreed. Most importantly for Clinton's people, who were in the front-runner spot at this point in 92, they avoided a debate the Sunday before the election. Not that the Bush people didn't try. When it was proposed by the Bush negotiating team, Paul Brontes, who had been in the room for the Dukakis Bush debate negotiations, remembered what James Baker had told them when they asked for a debate right before Election Day. No way will I let you get at my candidate the last week. If a statement is made, he will have no time to correct it. Well, once Brontes quoted back Baker's statement to the Bush campaign team, that was enough to kill that idea in that session. So what appears to be all simple matters are all things that can be negotiated in the pregame phase of a debate to try to influence the results, for at least what candidates think will be their advantage. Doesn't always work out that way, by the way. Carter, who initially didn't want debates, by the end of election was saying that the debate was what got him the election, since Ford had made a big mistake in the second debate. Kennedy's team wanted a lot of debates, but as it turned out, they did very well in the first debate, and then Nixon started to do better in the second and third, and it was a draw in the fourth. One debate would have been better for him. So in everything we're talking about today, we're talking about what teams think will be better for their candidate. Doesn't always mean they'll be right. But there are many ways you can try to influence these results. A panel of moderators, you know, seems innocent, right? That's good, though, if you want your candidate to be a bit evasive. If there's 4 reporters asking questions, they can only take so much time, and follow-up is difficult. You have to move on to the next reporter, so candidates can dodge. A single moderator, like a James Lehrer-type situation, can press answers, follow-up, and keep a deeper focus on one question. Town halls add some strange dynamics, because you've got all these other players who don't even know their players and hopefully are screened for their randomness and their impartiality. And they're not professional reporters. Now, this is important. 1992, Bush was totally thrown off during the debate when a woman asked him about the deficit, but meant the economy. Clinton then answered the question and understood what she meant. He answered that question about the economy. Bush was just simply confused and couldn't respond properly. A professional journalist would never have made such a mistake. People in town hall settings just simply are more timid than a reporter, and faced with even a challenger for the presidency of the United States is not normally someone that they're going to meet in their lives. And so they can be a little more timid in terms of follow-up, but they can also react emotionally in ways that can either help or hurt a candidate. Why debate negotiations can even be done so to make debates invisible. This is what was widely contended about the 1996 election, when President Clinton, as an incumbent in the lead, didn't want to necessarily debate, but knew that he was an able debater and he could handle it if needed. And Bob Dole, though the challenger, normally the challenger wants to debate, wasn't thrilled about a series of debate with, younger, more energetic, better debater Clinton, and agreed to just two debates, both of them during the World Series and without third-party candidate Perot. That decision was widely criticized. Third-party candidates, perhaps the American voter, are the loser in negotiations between our two major parties. The CPD rule is that a candidate would need 15% in five major polls to be up on the stage against the two-party candidates. It's a very high standard, only reached by Ross Perot in 1992. Anderson would not have gotten there in 1980, particularly if you're talking about five polls needed to show 15%. Would have been under that at the time of setting debates. The 1960 debate would result from the removal of Section 315 from the Federal Communications Code. Now, this is an equal time provision. This was suspended in 1960 to allow the networks to have a debate between the Democrats and the Republicans. In the argument for this suspension before Congress, we see from the network representatives the other side of this question. Now, they were arguing if the rule remained, that in 1960 they would have had to include 14 people up on the stage, not just Kennedy and Nixon, but also Merritt Curtis of the Constitution Party, Farrell Dobbs of the Socialist Workers, even Simon Gould of the American Vegetarian Party, in addition to prohibitionists, the other strains of socialists, and many other parties. This leads to the chicken and egg question. A candidate from the Constitution Party could speak. Maybe they'd get that 15%. But then, why should they get a chance to have TV coverage if they don't have enough supporters to justify it? Versus a party with seats in Congress, governorships, and a chance of winning the election if it were held on the day that we're discussing the debate at all. Does seem like that 15% standard is fairly high. And it is, of course, designed by two parties who don't want third parties in generally. Maybe it could be lowered to 8%. But then, do candidates just run celebrities to get to that 8%? Well, some third parties are already running celebrities without even that standard, but that's certainly possible. Or maybe, just once, we could have that debate that the networks loathed in 1960. We could just have one of those debates, all 14 people on the stage, two major party candidates, along with all those others, and then go ahead and have the two or three debates and see what happens. Why it doesn't happen? Well, the answer to that question reveals where the power lies. We don't have such debates because one or the other major party candidates would back out. There's no other legal mechanism and not really enough popular interest in seeing all these third party candidates to force them to do this right now. Could certainly change. So we've learned that there are a lot of chefs in the stew besides Romney and Obama, managing a debate before it happens. And there's a lot of precedent in history, so some negotiation in 2012 wasn't even necessary. It's just accepted now. But at least the debate itself is real, right? Once the cameras start? Well, I mean, yes, of course it is. And you might think that you're seeing the real candidate. And of course, you will be. But you'll also be seeing the preparation of that candidate, who the candidate is after they've got a briefing book in their head. You're seeing the preparation or lack thereof at their best or at their worst. Debate prep in 1960 was thorough for then-Senator Kennedy. He was given an extensive briefing book, which they called the Nixonopedia, which had every one of Nixon's opinions on things. And he had note cards on important issues given to him by his aides, Ted Sorensen and Richard Goodwin. They peppered the senator with questions the night before and the morning of the debate. And right before he had to show up to the studio, took a little nap, he had supper alone. Nixon, on the other hand, had figured, okay, I'm in Chicago for the debate. I'll meet with the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners and try to get some of the union vote in the morning. But it was a hostile crowd, and he was annoyed by the meeting. And after that meeting, he retreated to his hotel room. One of his staff members said, "We kept pushing for Nixon to have some give and take with the staff." But Nixon refused. The vice president just simply said he knew how to debate. And indeed he did. Nixon had won his first congressional seat, principally because he challenged a longtime Democratic incumbent to a debate and beat him. Yet after his poor performance with Senator Kennedy in that 1960 debate, he would then engage in more rigorous preparation for the second and third, which most viewers thought he won. Despite their more extensive preparation in 1960, even Kennedy's staff would not have recognized the scene in 1992 as Dick Darman, Bush campaign advisor, arrived to the White House with sunglasses and a saxophone from Toys R Us. He was to be the Clinton in the debate prep. And John Sununu went as far to put on a set of plastic ears for his role as the Perot in the debate prep. They were to go through a complete rehearsal of the debate. And indeed, it's common these days for people to relish that role of being one or the other opponent in the debate prep, and it's announced in the newspapers, Romney's opponent pretending to be Obama will be Bob Portman of Ohio. Sununu and Darman were a bit light on the president. His prep was light compared to Governor Clinton's. A quick rehearsal, and then a look at the briefing books and some questions around the Oval Office. Several full dress rehearsals were held in Camp Clinton. Washington lawyer Bob Bennett played Bush, and Oklahoma Congressman Mike Snyder played Ross Perot. The two went after Clinton aggressively, and then Clinton was critiqued by a group of judges. They did this several times. In the first dress, the campaign staff acting as judges scored Clinton third in the debate. He had forgotten the good lines. He waffled on the draft question. He was defensive. When asked about his time in Russia, he was supposed to mention how Bush's father ran against McCarthy. Clinton didn't even remember to use the line. The campaign staff was heavy with criticism, so much so that VP candidate Al Gore was dispatched for a quick consoling phone call afterwards. Jim Carville said it was all part of the plan. The job was to cream him, to keep him from getting complacent. And indeed, in the real debate, Clinton would remember and use the line about President Bush's father. Carville may have perfected the prep, but he didn't invent this dress rehearsal. Ford's campaign in 1976 did a full dress, including the pretend media asking questions. As Ford's media advisor said, the prep is so that nothing can surprise the president. Jimmy Carter, on the other hand, thought it was unnatural and told the press, "I am not going to practice against a dummy opponent or make up cute speeches or anything like that." His debating would be real. But after the first debate, that real performance was considered poor compared to the president. And so Carter upped his practice. And as president, he engaged in a limited prep. He did have a California political science professor who knew Governor Reagan come in and try to prepare him for his debate against him. Carter's aides cringed when the professor, who knew Reagan well, made the president look foolish in the debate. Every time President Carter said something, the political science professor, Sam Popkins, would come out with a folksy line. "I thought the Marines were going to take out my kneecaps after I beat him in that debate." Yet Carter was now president. He lacked the time and, to some extent, the interest in practicing more rehearsals. In 1996, Bob Dole refused prep, thinking it was silly. As Dole said, "It's like filling up the tank with gas. There's only so much more you can put in." Yet it's clear if you want to win, you can't fully follow Dole's thinking. One of the most noticed scenes of the 1992 debates, and it was in the second debate, President Bush, and we're talking, of course, about H.W. Bush, he glanced at his watch. It looked like he was just looking to get out of that room, to get out of there, and kind of symbolic of his presidency being over and all of that, certainly caused him to lose the debate in the eyes of most people watching. Yet that shot should never have happened. The rules of the debate were that there would be no reaction shots. You shouldn't have been able to see Bush glancing at his watch. Only the candidate speaking would be on camera. But in Clinton's debate prep, the staff had prepared an entire mock studio that looked exactly like that town hall. They knew where the cameras would be, and they found that if Clinton got up in certain spots, he could stand in an area where the camera had to show either Bush or in other areas where it had to show Perot in the reaction shot. This kind of prep paid dividends in that debate. So I think what's going on, we have a bit of a debate freeze. Now, that could change if some major issue comes up or if people just simply do get tired of waiting for the debates. You got a couple weeks here. To the fact that there is a secretive organization created by the two parties that runs these debates, the fact that negotiators have determined a lot of these debates, and the fact that candidates intensely prepare for these debates. So you're seeing maybe how well they run through their scripts versus how well they perform. Does that limit your enjoyment of the debates? Well, it might to some extent. I still think that, like any kind of live TV, debates are still so important. And no matter how much negotiations and scripting that goes on, there's still always a chance that anything can happen. But I hope it's been useful to see some of the things that go on before debates and that they're not that new. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics. And if you do like the program, I can't say it enough, please tell someone about it so that they can become a listener. Thanks for listening.